From the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, this is The Steady Stater, a podcast dedicated to discussing limits to growth in the steady state economy.
Welcome to the show. I am your host, Brian Check, and our guest today is Doug LaFollette, the longtime Wisconsin Secretary of State. Doug was well known as a highly effective environmentalist before getting involved in politics. That was back in the day when Wisconsin provided a lot of leadership in conservation affairs and environmental politics. Doug was one of the state organizers of the first Earth Day, the biggest environmental event ever. At CASI, we have a special appreciation for Doug because he really gets it about the limits to growth and the need for a steady state economy. He's on the short list, short so far at least, of elected politicians who've signed the CASI position on economic growth. Doug LaFollette, welcome to the Steady Stater.
Hey, it's great to talk to you, and it's great to be able to discuss this very critical issue for our future and for the planet Earth.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. You know, Doug, it seems like you were an environmentalist at a pretty young age. What was it that got you interested in the environment? Are there any specific incidents that stand out as punctuating that interest, or was it more of a gradual concern?
Well, as a young person, I always liked the outdoors, and I spent all my free time out in the woods collecting frogs or whatever, you know. And so I loved that part of nature. And of course, Wisconsin is famous for being a beautiful place. And then when I started teaching, I taught a course on environmental science that I helped design that. But all that sort of came primarily because of that Earth Day in 1970, where for the first time, I think in my life, really, and for the country, thanks to Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin, people began to focus on the fact that things were getting pretty bad. And because of that, something needed to be done. The air was bad, the water was polluted, the fish were dying, and it was necessary for us to do something. And that came to a focus, and that got me very interested in the politics of the whole issue.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, I was growing up myself in Wisconsin at the time, up on the edge of Green Bay, and I remember some of those god-awful alewife die-offs in the Green Bay of Lake Michigan and over on the actual shore of Lake Michigan proper as well. And what were some of the other environmental problems that were popping up at the time in Wisconsin? Because, you know, we hear about some of the other parts of the country, Cuyahoga River and so on, but what was going on in Wisconsin?
Well, it's a long story, and the issues have gotten more and more complex. But the primary issue, I think, at that time was what was typical across the country, because it was what people could smell and what they could see. And that was air pollution and water pollution. Those were the two big issues we talked about. And because, as I said, there was black smoke coming out of the smokestacks of the power plants because they didn't have electrostatic precipitators yet. And the fish were dying because the sewage plants were dumping raw sewage into the water. And that was causing an oxygen depletion, and the fish couldn't live without the oxygen. So those were the major issues at that time. After the first Earth Day, and I started teaching about environmental science, and people started paying attention, more and more complicated issues begin to show up, like toxic pollution and chemicals and issues of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide causing acid rain, for example. And the ozone layer was being affected and the ozone hole was opening up. And I could go on and on, but those issues begin to come after the Earth Day when we begin to analyze the problems more carefully.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's obvious that you have a pretty good background in environmental science and biology, and I didn't even mention your educational background at the beginning, but maybe you can tell us. I think you have a PhD from Columbia?
Yeah, because I had a great high school chemistry teacher, I sort of oriented towards chemistry rather than biology, even though I love the outdoors and the biological interests. But I ended up getting my PhD at Columbia in organic chemistry. And I started out teaching organic chemistry until the Earth Day. And then after Earth Day, I designed and started teaching the first environmental class. And I wrote a little book called The Survival Handbook, which talked about all the different environmental issues. And in writing that book and working with other people around the country who had become alerted and active after the Earth Day, we begin to talk about these other more complicated issues, much more systemic issues. If I can go on for a minute, for example, after Earth Day, we cleaned up the black smoke. We passed laws, thanks to Gaylord Nelson in Washington. They passed the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act. A lot of good laws got passed. And we cleaned up the black smoke, and we cleaned up the sewage plants. So the fish came back, and the black smoke went away. But then we discovered that you couldn't eat the fish. We had to have advisories to tell people don't eat the fish because they had mercury and they had chemicals in them that were not healthy. And even though the smoke wasn't black anymore, sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide were coming out, causing acid rain, as I mentioned. And that's when we begin to see it was much more complicated than just cleaning up the black smoke. There were systemic problems in the way we operated our world in terms of economic growth, in terms of approving and not approving the use of chemicals and chemical fertilizer and all the different complicated issues. And that, of course, led to the big issue of population. And I remember Gaylord Nelson talking about population back then. There were 3.8 billion people on the Earth in 1970. Now it's more than twice that. And Gaylord Nelson and myself and many other people said at that time, we have to do something to stop this growth of population because we already have probably as many people as the Earth can support at 3.8. And we have to avoid going up to 4, 5, 6, 7. But that didn't happen. And the combination of the population growth and the, quote, economic growth, more and more industry, more and more stuff being produced, has led to the current situation where we're now destroying the climate, which was an issue that no one thought about in 1970.
All right. Well, that is quite a systemic summary. Yeah, got rid of some of the most obvious problems, only to find more nefarious ones coming down the pipe. Well, now you've mentioned Gaylord Nelson a few times, and it sounds like you worked directly with him in organizing those first Earth Day events. Actually, maybe you should remind our listeners a little bit about the life and legacy of Gaylord Nelson.
Well, Gaylord Nelson grew up in northern Wisconsin, a little town called Clear Lake. And he loved the environment, and he loved that part of Wisconsin. And he got involved in politics, sort of like I did, I guess, thinking he could do some good. And he got elected the governor of Wisconsin, and he was a leader in conservation. We didn't use the word environment then, it was conservation. And he was very well known as a conservation governor, trying to work to protect Wisconsin. And then he was elected a U.S. senator, and he went to Washington, and he became frustrated because people in Washington, other senators, weren't paying much attention to the environment. So because of that, he had the idea of the Earth Day, so that all across the country, people would stop for one day and take stock of the environment and decide that something needed to be done. And it was very successful. Millions of people stopped in schools and universities and celebrated that first Earth Day. And after that, he was able, with the help of other senators. Back in those days, there were quite a few good senators. Today, the Senate has totally collapsed, in my opinion, but let's not bother with that. There were a number of good senators at the time, and he, with other people and his leadership, they passed, as I said, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Environmental Policy Act. All of those things happened in the 70s.
Right.
He remained a senator for a number of years, and then he stopped and retired, and no, he's no longer with us now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember I had just one opportunity to meet him in Washington, D.C. at the offices of the Wilderness Society, I think. And I'll never forget talking with him because I felt like I was talking to a real conservation legend. And I used to run across his daughter, Tia, when she worked for the Nature Conservancy right across the river in Arlington. You may know, Doug, that TNC's headquarters were two blocks from the Fish and Wildlife Service headquarters where I was. And I might add that, like you, Tia is a CASI signatory, so I do know that she gets it about the need for a steady state economy, too. As I understand it, she's been back in Madison for some time now and also involved in environmental politics at some level. Do you know what she's up to there?
Yeah, she, after her father died, she kind of wanted to come home to Wisconsin. So she left the Nature Conservancy, and I actually hired her as the executive secretary of the Wisconsin Land Board. There's a land board in Wisconsin that manages a lot of land in northern Wisconsin that still remains from the original federal land grant. And I'm one of the three commissioners, and we don't need to talk a lot about that unless you want to. But there was an opening as the executive secretary of that land board at the time. And I recommended her, and my fellow commissioners interviewed her, and we hired her. And she had that position for some time until, and I have to say this, a number of Republican legislators who were absolute jerks went after her because of her environmental interests, and they harassed her to the point that she finally quit. And now she is the head of a new foundation, which was started, the name of which escapes me, I apologize, that works on climate disruption. Its primary focus is on climate issues, and she's quite happy with that now.
Oh, that's good. But yeah, that sounds like a rough experience with those legislators. Well, Doug, this is a great conversation, and I want to get right back to it. But right now, we need to take a short non-commercial break with Rick Tibbetts.
Hi there. We hope you're enjoying the show. I just wanted to take this brief intermission to announce some good news here at CASI. We just published a new book called Uncommon Sense, Shortcomings of the Human Mind for Handling Big Picture, Long-Term Challenges by author Peter Seidel. We promise you this book is a true page-turner. It's already received high praise from fellow renowned author Alan Weissman, who said, "The premise behind Uncommon Sense is the biggest question in human history. Ingenious as our species may be, is it also wise enough to do what it will take to keep our civilization viable before it's too late?" Peter Seidel lays out all that ails the Earth in this make-or-break century and leaves it to us to decide whether our saga continues or ends all too soon. You can get your own copy today by going to steadystate.org, panning over to the Discover button, and clicking Steady State Press in the drop-down menu. Now, back to the show.
You know, I want to go back to something you mentioned a few minutes ago, which was that before talk of the environment and environmentalism, it was about conservation. And I know that, of course, to be certainly the case in Wisconsin, because I went to the university there at Madison and under that Aldo Leopold lineage there in wildlife ecology. And I was wondering if, did Aldo Leopold kind of play into the early stages with Gaylord Nelson or yourself in terms of helping to understand these the systemic nature of the problems coming down the pike?
I guess I'd have to say probably not. I don't remember any much involvement with Leopold at that time. I mean, that was sort of after Leopold. People referred back to Leopold and John Muir and some of the famous Wisconsin conservation leaders of their time. But I think after the Earth Day and time forward to now, they were more of historic legends rather than active people who influenced the stuff that was going on.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, as I recall, he died in 1948. He died of a heart attack fighting a fire, I think, in those the central part of Wisconsin. And then, but the thing that I remember about his the book, the Sand County Almanac, you know, his most famous book, was actually in the preface, where the second from last sentence, I think it was something like, nothing could be more salutary at this point than a little healthy contempt for a plethora of material blessings. So it's a mouthful, but it led me to think that Aldo Leopold, shortly before his death, his premature death there, he was starting to move toward, well, ecological economics, and in particular, the recognition of conspicuous consumption as just bad citizenship.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think those early leaders understood that a lot better than people did sometime later, when sort of, you know, after the Second World War, and then everything started gearing up. We started making cars and making televisions and making. And people kind of forgot about the need for conservation. And it became sort of a wild consumerism. And that went on throughout the 50s and 60s. And that's what led to the problems that then resulted in Earth Day, because all that consumption and production led to the pollution problems that we've talked about in the air and the water. And I think another historical point that you remind me of would be a quote from Gaylord Nelson. And I heard him say this many times. And he said, people are confused when they think that environment is a subset of the economy. He said, that's backwards. The economy is a subset of the environment. And if we don't have an environment, we're not going to have an economy. And that, I think, sort of is like the quote you just read, was the realization that the environment was more important than the, quote, economy and the growth that we've been consumed with ever since 1970s, probably. And I think that he realized the importance of trying to limit the population growth and trying to limit the wild growth of economic systems, which would impair the environment.
Yeah, that's right. That was certainly his most famous quote in terms of ecological economics. He was like a predecessor, especially when you think of political predecessing, you know, and in raising awareness of limits to growth, calling the economy a subset of the ecosystem instead of vice versa. And that makes me wonder, because you hear the quote, sometimes you see it attributed to Gaylord Nelson, sometimes you see it attributed to Herman Daly. You think that they knew each other?
I don't know, but I can't believe they did not, because they were both so much in the leadership of beginning to question the limits to growth. And Herman Daly wrote his very famous first book, The Limits to Growth. And I'm sure Gaylord Nelson knew that. He probably read that book. They probably met. I didn't know Herman Daly in the early days, but I got to know him, and I invited him to Wisconsin. He came to Wisconsin at my invitation and gave a lecture which was very well received. And of course, he talked about the insanity of unlimited growth on a limited planet, as he is so well articulated. And then when I started teaching some classes, I used one of his books for the students. One of his later books, it was called For the Common Good. And I still recommend that book to people because it was co-written by Herman Daly, an economist and a theologian, I believe.
Yeah, Tom.
The first chapter of that book, for the Common Good, is the best analysis of the economic system and its flaws that I've ever read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's absolutely a classic. And we're fortunate enough that we're going to have Herman on the podcast in a few weeks. He'll be the Thanksgiving week guest. Yeah. And so I'll ask him about that too, if he knew Gaylord Nelson and what that relationship was like. And but you know, so back to you now as a deep operative in the environmental movement over the decades, how would you describe the relationship between environmentalism and limits to growth? Was that a central message at the beginning, or was it always sort of a satellite issue? What was that like?
Well, in the beginning, as I mentioned, Gaylord Nelson and many other people realized the population growth was a concern. Mm-hmm. And we had to be concerned about that. The economic growth issue wasn't discussed as much in the beginning of the environmental movement, which started, let's say, in 1970 with Earth Day. There were people talking about it, but it was pretty much ignored, I think, and partly because the powerful interests in this country, the powerful business interests who were making money hand over fist, producing everything. And as long as they could keep on doing that and providing jobs for people and providing stuff for people, whether it be televisions or microwaves or whatever, that sort of took the role of the United States' future for a number of years. And people like Herman Daly, I think, were sort of a voice in the wilderness in terms of being ignored, because people didn't want to hear that. People didn't want to hear that they had to slow down a little bit and maybe not have quite so much, and maybe only have two children instead of four. Those things were not well received by people.
Yeah. It almost makes you wonder if it wasn't such a coincidence that the first and only major amendments to the Employment Act, which originally was passed in 1946, happened in 1978 when it became, let's see, the Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act. You have to wonder if the political, the system of the time wasn't starting to detect a groundswell of awareness building about limits to growth and, you know, took action to head it off at the pass.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that is something you can see through history in terms of in the 70s and early 80s, when we passed, as I said, the Clean Air Act and Clean Water, and a lot of progress has been made. But then when people like Gaylord Nelson and myself and many, many others started talking about the more complicated problems, you know, it was easy to get rid of the black smoke. The power companies complained about it. Oh, we can't do it. We can't do it. We passed a law. They did it. It wasn't a big deal. But then the more complicated problems of toxic chemicals and acid rain, that meant curtailing some economic growth maybe. And when they saw that, they began to organize. And by the middle of the 80s and on into the 1990, the anti-environmental movement begin to organize, and they begin to work very hard politically to elect senators and members of Congress who would be against the environmental regulations. And that's when we had what I call the backlash. I've written an article about the history of this whole thing. And around then, we moved into what I call the backlash, where there was a serious backlash against environmental issues. And that was orchestrated by some of these foundations, like the Heritage Foundation, and some of these right-wing organizations that were campaigning against environmental regulations. And that has continued up today. I mean, let's jump ahead a minute. What is what is our current President Trump's one of the biggest his accomplishments? Getting
the
rid
rollbacks.
Of environmental regulation. He's proud of the fact that he has gotten rid of environmental regulations. And this is 2020, and I'm talking about 1980, 1985, when this anti-environmental movement first began. And we've been fighting it ever since, trying to counteract that. But they have the money and the power. And so it's a little discouraging, Brian, I have to admit.
You've been listening to a conversation between Brian Check and Doug La Follette, the current Secretary of State of Wisconsin. There was so much great material in this episode, we decided to break it into two parts. So, be sure to tune in next week for part two of this riveting discussion. This is The Steady Stater. I'm Rick Tibbetts. See you next time.